Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, after a lifetime of working with the poorest children in America, Jonathan Kozol helps us understand their harsh realities and the factors that help the most disadvantaged kids to thrive. Then, how the meaning of the Second Amendment has changed since its introduction and what it might mean for today's debate about gun laws. 25 years ago, Jonathan Kozol documented the harsh realities of some of the poorest Americans in their struggles to survive. In his latest book, he revisits their lives. Some didn't survive, but others more than thrived, using their successes to contribute to other underprivileged kids. What were the factors that made the difference between the ones who survived and the ones who didn't? One of the keys, says Jonathan Kozol, is education. Jonathan Kozol joins us now. He's the author of numerous books, Death at an Early Age, Savage Inequalities, Amazing Grace, and Fire in the Ashes, 25 Years Among the Poorest Children in America. Welcome, Jonathan Kozol.
Thank you.
I'd like to start with how you began down this path interviewing these incredibly impoverished people and documenting their lives.
I've been teaching and working with inner city kids since 1964, when I first heard the voice of Dr. Martin Luther King, and then decided to go right into an inner city classroom and teach kids in order to see if I could make a difference on my own. That was in Boston, where I'd gone to college at Harvard. Actually, I was about to go back into academic life and become a professor, but Dr. King's voice really changed my life forever. Starting in the late 1980s, early 1990s, I began spending almost all my time in New York City, in a section of the city called Mott Haven. Mott Haven was then and is today the poorest neighborhood in all of the South Bronx. South Bronx is still today the poorest congressional district in America. I mean, I'd never seen poverty like this before. Still very, very poor there. The average household income for a family of just mother and three kids is, believe it or not, $17,000 for everything. Principals knew me from earlier books like Savage Inequalities, and so they let me go right into the schools and let me go in any classroom I wanted. I walked into kindergarten, and I met some kids that to this day, among my closest friends, not all of them survived. There were three young men, little boys then, who never really recovered from the battering they underwent in that neighborhood, which was just like the worst place in the world you could ever bring up a child. It was not simply destitute, but the schools there were probably among the worst in the United States, still are. And three of the boys never recovered. All three took their lives, ultimately, one by a bullet to the brain, another intentionally by an overdose of heroin, and a third by doing something crazy. This was in New York. They ride on the tops of trains under the subway tunnels of New York. It's called surfing. And this boy had just been given a horrible time in the schools and never received the services he needed. His friends were lying down flat on the top of the train, but he, in a moment of bravado, as if to say, "This city can't beat me down," suddenly sat up, lifted his head up, and waved at his friends, and a steel beam from overhead struck his skull. He shuddered twice, and he was dead. And there were several kids who never did recover from what they went through as children. On the other hand, and this is the main part of my new book, Fire in the Ashes, there were a lot of kids who did survive and didn't really survive, but in part because of their own guts, drive, and persistence, but more because of people who could intervene in their lives, grown-ups, who could help them escape that miserable school and the awful high schools in the Bronx. There were a lot of kids who have had extraordinary victories. And one of them is this little girl, Pineapple, whom I met in kindergarten that year, the first week I was ever in the South Bronx. Her school, among its other problems, it was badly underfunded, as are all those inner-city schools to this day. It was also an ugly place. It smelled. The cafeteria was down the basement, and it was like something from the Middle Ages. It was like a feeding trough for cattle. She had 34 kids in her class most of her years, and 36 got larger. By the way, it's still like that in New York. It's back to 36, 38 kids in a class. So that's not as bad as Los Angeles, where several teachers I know have more than 40 kids in a class. Anyway, her teachers kept quitting because the classes were so huge. So the principal, in order to try to make up for the huge class size, put into effect this really rigid uniformity of instruction, a kind of a drill and kill curriculum where everything was geared to the tests. We see this all over the nation now because of No Child Left Behind. Test results were everything. It didn't work. Kids didn't get to read any wonderful books that would actually excite them to want to learn to read. None of those beautiful children's classics like The Very Hungry Caterpillar, books like that, which they read in the suburbs. Nothing like that. They just had these horrible, boring, sort of teach-to-the-test material. It didn't work. Pineapple learned nothing at that school. In fifth grade, I sat down with her, and she couldn't write a sentence longer than five words or read one. Then she was really smart, spunky, that she'd been artificially retarded by the institutional racism of America, by the vicious way we treat minority children. She was lucky. I had friends who helped me with this. We got her into a terrific prep school. And by that, I don't mean one of these slogan-loaded, profit-making charter schools, but a prep school for rich children. And suddenly, instead of 36 in her class, she had 15. And her teachers at the prep school didn't have to test the kids to death. The children could learn from excitement instead of fear of examinations. And people always say, did it work? You bet it did. She not only suddenly made up 4 years of lost education at prep school, but graduated successfully. She'll be beginning her senior year of college. She's what I mean by the fire in the ashes. Pineapple's experience shows us what we could do in the public schools if we spent the kind of money on impoverished children that we spend on the kids who live in places like Beverly Hills and Brentwood, or the children who go to exclusive private schools like the daughters of President Obama.
You met a lot of these kids in a particular homeless type of shelter.
Originally, I had met some of these kids when they were homeless in the late 1980s in Manhattan. But I include that in the book just to explain how I got to know the Bronx. Once the city shut down the homeless shelters, as they did finally, they moved all these black and Latino people en masse and against their will, usually, into this dismal neighborhood in the South Bronx. In other words, they wouldn't dream of helping them move into a neighborhood in a middle-class, working-class neighborhood in Manhattan. No, they put them in the South Bronx where they'd be out of sight, where no one could see them. And then once they were there, of course, they got a classic taste of segregated and viciously unequal education. And it was like back to Plessy versus Ferguson. Forget about Brown versus Board of Education. It was like back to the 1890s. I have to say, the Republican administrations have always been viciously opposed to at least giving these kids equal education, because that means higher taxes on rich people. Instead of money, they've given us this testing nightmare, No Child Left Behind. But the truth is, President Obama hasn't done much better. He never speaks about the savage inequalities between rich neighborhoods and poor neighborhoods. He never speaks about the fact that wonderful, dedicated teachers in Los Angeles are coping with 40 kids in a class. I happen to speak at a school in Washington called Sidwell Friends, which is a very expensive private school where the president's children go. And they have like 15 in a class. And Bill Pineapple once said, if really small classes are good enough for the children of the president, sons and daughters of hedge fund billionaires, why isn't the same thing considered good enough for the poorest children of the poorest mothers in America? And I thought that was a good question. Pineapple, by the way, hasn't lost her sense of loyalty to the place she came from. Some kids, when they make it finally, as she's done, and they get to college, and naturally, like many Americans, they'll say, now I can make some real money. They'll major in business or something, and they'll go to Wall Street. They might start at $100,000 a year. She's told me She's going to take an extra year and get certified to be a public school teacher, and she wants to go back to the Bronx to teach kids. And she said to me, Dr. King said this once, pass the torch along. And she said, that's what I've decided I need to do in life, pass it on, do it for the little ones I left behind. So her victory isn't just a materialistic victory. It's also a moral victory. And there are five other kids in the book like her, all of whom, having won spectacular victories, are now going back to share it with the people they left behind in the neighborhood. I admire President Obama, but he never speaks about these vicious inequalities. And in one way, he's made things worse. This testing nightmare, this thing of obsessively testing and retesting poor kids and drilling them all year to take these tests. I'm not talking about useful tests, like what we call diagnostic tests, where the teacher administers the test and corrects it herself and says, okay, I see Shaniqua needs more help with long division, and then she can actually do it the next day. I'm talking about bubble tests that the kids take, and they don't help the teacher at all because the results don't come back for 6 or 8 months. By the time the results come back, the child's not in her class anymore. The real purpose of these tests, in my opinion, is not to improve the education of poor children. It really represents an attempt to humiliate the teachers of poor children. On a larger scale, it represents a right-wing attack upon the whole idea of public education as a sacred American legacy. The same people who push obsessively for testing, these people are always saying to me, you know, I still know some wealthy people in New York, there are a few of them still speak to me, you know, and they'll say, Jonathan, can you really buy your way to better education for those children? You know, those children in quotes. And these are people who send their kids to private schools that cost $50,000 a year. And I'll just look them in the eyes and I say, I don't know. It seems to do the trick for your kids, doesn't it? Instead of being willing to pay a much higher rate of taxation at the top levels of income, what they're doing is scapegoating the teachers in these schools and just humiliating them. They're printing the names of the teachers in newspapers, and they rate them according to their students' test scores. A teacher who's working her heart out but has 42 kids in her class that year, and a quarter of them are recent immigrants who don't yet speak English. It doesn't matter if it's that teacher or a lucky teacher who has only 20 kids. They both get judged by the same standards. There's something brutal about this, and it's driving away the best teachers from our inner city school.
When you look at all of the kids that you tracked after knowing them 25 years ago, some you stayed in touch with, some you had to track down, I understand.
I kept in touch with most of them through the years. The kids I wrote about are now in their early 20s, so...
Let's talk about some of them. In addition to Pineapple, some were very sad stories and some were very inspiring stories, like the Pineapple story. There were two in the very beginning that were very difficult to get through, Pietro and Vicky. If you could tell us a little bit about their experience and then maybe give us an analysis about what distinguished the ones who were able to succeed, like these moral successes, such as the one you described, and an analysis of the institutions for these very poor children.
Let me just focus on one child, Pietro's son, Christopher. I knew him when he was 8 years old, 9 years old. I met them in a homeless shelter. Once the city forced them all to move to the Bronx, they'd invite me up to come and have dinner with them at their home. They lived with their grandma also, and she really held the family together. And I'd go there for Thanksgiving and things like that. There were three children in the family. There was Christopher, who had been 8 or 9 when I met him. And then there were two little girls who were only 3 or 4 at the time. And the little girls somehow, I don't know quite how to explain it, but some people would think, well, the littler they are, the more they must suffer. But it's not exactly true. They were so young that they didn't understand that they were being treated like dirt by the city of New York. They didn't get the picture. They didn't realize also that most people don't have to live that way. But the older child, the boy, who is pre-adolescent and then adolescent, teenager, he got the point of it. And he saw the humiliation of parents you know, he went on the train on his own, so he saw how the rich lived. He saw the expensive stores on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. And in every decade, we seem to have an economic crisis. But for some reason, those expensive stores like Saks Fifth Avenue are always full of customers. So, you know, even at this moment, there's plenty of super rich people in New York. And he saw this, and it embittered him. And it embittered him to a point that distorted his entire personality. And in order to survive, he had to learn to be a tough kid. See, the little girls didn't have to be tough, because as one of them, Miranda, said to me, she's now a good friend, she said, he's the one who went out in the street and panhandled for us. She said, I didn't know it at the time, but he's the one who was dealing drugs to bring home money for us. So the girls remained kind of clean of spirit, whereas he became a really tough guy, and I always worried, and he spent several years in prison for a vicious crime where he and some other boys threw somebody under a subway train. The person fortunately did not die. And he became kind of evil. But I was reminded that nothing he did was ever really quite as bad as what the city had done to him in the first place. That's the point. I was reminded of a line by one of my favorite poets, W.H. Auden, who said, when will we ever know what all school children learn? Those to whom evil is done do evil in return. That's not always true, but in his case, it certainly was. I used to worry, will he kill somebody someday? Well, he didn't. Instead, he killed himself. He finally took his own life. Now, why did he collapse when other kids like Pineapple and, oh, there's so many others in the book, like Jeremy and the others who went on to college, why did they succeed? Well, I'll be honest with you. To some degree, it's a matter simply of the child's strength of character. But to a large degree, it's because the ones who were successful also happened to have fascinating personalities. As little kids, they caught the eye of benevolent grown-ups, people who could help them. And Pineapple was just delectably funny. She used to boss me around all the time, tried to fix me up with her third grade teacher and so forth. You know, a little girl like that catches your attention. And the same was true of about five other kids. So once they caught the attention of grown-ups, they benefited from philanthropy, from charity. They got scholarships to terrific schools, boarding schools, prep schools. They got the kind of education rich people get. The thing is, charity is a lovely thing, and frankly, I'd never turn it down, but charity is not a substitute for systematic justice. It's too selective. If there's any lesson in this book, it's not that we should celebrate exceptionality of opportunity. It's that we should give the very same thing they got to every kid in America within the public schools. They shouldn't have to charm you to death to get that.
That was going to lead into my next question, which is if the other kids would have gotten that kind of attention from an adult, from a charity, from a scholarship, would their lives have turned out absolutely better? Was that the key, in your opinion?
I described three boys who died at an early age. I think in one of these cases, the boy probably was on such a self-destructive bent by the time he was 10 or 11 or 12. I'm not sure anything would have turned him back. But in the other cases, the answer to your question is yes. If we intervene early enough and those boys got the kind of help that the troubled rich kids get when they not only go to terrific schools where the teachers can give them a lot of individual attention, but where they also get good health care and social workers or school psychologists who have plenty of time to talk to them and listen to them. Because those kids are smart, I think almost all of them would have succeeded. Maybe they would not all have gone to four-year colleges and graduated, but they certainly would have gone through community colleges, and they certainly would be leading reasonably decent lives today. A lot of people say to me, oh, Jonathan, you forget all the other forces of poverty that work against these kids. Can the schools really make a difference? And my answer is yes, they can. If they're terrific schools. There are a lot of liberals who are kind of, I call them impotent liberals, powerless liberals, futile liberals, who they'll point to so many different aspects of poverty And they say, well, if you change this, that's good, but what about all these seven other factors? They leave you with this sense that nothing's going to work. So they don't say this, but the really hidden message is, why try? And my answer is, no, I'm not going to give in. I'm not going to give in that way. You know, that's too easy. That's the luxury of intellectuals who don't know the children. My answer is, if you give these kids spectacular, extravagant, richly funded education, and not in ugly, smelly buildings, but in beautiful buildings, if you give them buildings that give them the message, we value you a lot, that's why we're putting you in this beautiful school, and then you give them teachers who are relaxed and comfortable and can sit and talk with them at length because the class is so small, and can refer them for counseling when they need help and so forth. I happen to believe that superb education can be the lever of change in our society. And in any case, it's the only one over which we have immediate power because the other factors are so complex and cloudy. You know, how do you get spectacular health care to every little kid in every corner of America? I don't know how. I don't know what you do about rundown slum housing stock all over America. It would take years to rebuild all those buildings or to knock them down and put up decent ones. But I do know this, that if we got the kind of resources in our inner city public schools that they already have in wealthy towns like Brentwood and Beverly Hills, if we got that money today, 5 years from now, we would see a whole generation of young people who suddenly have a real chance at growing up into a happy and ethical and contributive maturity as empowered and effective American grown-ups.
Well, Jonathan Kozol, thank you so much. Again, the book is called Fire in the Ashes, 25 Years Among the Poorest Children in America.
Thank you.
When we come back, how the meaning of the Second Amendment has changed over time and what it means for today's gun debates. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The latest and most lethal mass shooting in America that occurred in Orlando again raised questions about how to address gun violence, particularly in light of gun advocates' arguments about the meaning of the Second Amendment. Our next guests have traced the historical meaning of the Second Amendment from the very first days that it was drafted and proposed. Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law and author of The Second Amendment, a biography, and Adam Winkler, professor of law at UCLA and the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Thank you so much for being with us. It's great to have you here on the Scholar's Circle. Both of you have fascinating books about the Second Amendment and how it's evolved and been constructed over American history. Perhaps we should start with the drafting of the Second Amendment itself. Michael Waldman, let's start with you. You wrote that the drafting of the Constitution occurred in secret by revolutionaries who wanted a strong central government. These were the Federalists. But the anti-Federalists who opposed the Constitution were worried about losing their state militias. Start us here and tell us how the Second Amendment came about.
thank you. Yes, the drafting of the Second Amendment, as with so much of the debate over it over many years, really had to do so much about people's fears and feelings about government. So the revolutionaries who had helped to fight the American Revolution, who helped fight the War of Independence, they saw that these state militias were cherished, were revered by the public, had done such a great job at, say, Lexington and Concord, but weren't up to the task of actually pulling together a modern, or for its time, a modern nation. They moved the country in their draft constitution toward a more consolidated government. At the time, people believed that a great threat to liberty here in the colonies or in the United States and in England, too, was something called a standing army, the idea that there'd be a professional army at the whim of the king that could oppress people and could oppress their rights. The alternative to that were these militias. We know it now as the well-regulated militia, but it was something very different from anything we really have right now. It was the militias were made up of all adult men, really eventually all adult white men, from the age of 16 to 60. They were required to be part of the militia, and they were required to own a gun, and they actually had their guns at home. And so that was the norm. That was the central military force of the new nation, were these 13 state militias. When the Constitution was released, it was a great moment, a great debate. We all know that the huge tumult and controversy that resulted, one of the fears that anti-federalists had was that the new national government would crush these state militias. As you know, and as your listeners probably know, the fight for the Constitution went state by state, and eventually to get it enacted, to get it ratified, there was the idea that there would be some amendments later on, maybe a Bill of Rights added. And that was what led to the inclusion eventually of the Second Amendment.
You found that there wasn't much of a discussion around owning a gun for self-defense so much as it was around the civic duty of serving in a militia.
As best we know, and there's always the fog of history, people had guns. They were expected to be able to have guns. There was a tradition of being able to defend yourself and your home. But if you look at the notes from James Madison's notes from the Constitutional Convention, or the debate on the floor of the House of Representatives when they marked up the Second Amendment, or with scattered exceptions, when you look at the official records of the ratifying conventions, what they were really talking about was the right to bear arms against tyranny through these militias. And, you know, people ask me, was it an individual right or was it the militia that was protected? And it was really both. It was the individual right to bear arms to fulfill the duty to serve in a militia. And, of course, that's such a different worldview than we have in so many ways. It's very hard to take that and translate it into something current and relevant now.
Adam Winkler, you also explored the various iterations of the Second Amendment before it became what it is now, and the language that you found from people introducing from various states seemed like it was that the state could not disarm people unless the person was creating a public threat. What can you tell us about some of that language?
Thanks for having me on, first and foremost, and always a pleasure to be here with Michael Waldman. And I should say that Michael's right. You know, when you look at the history of the drafting of the Second Amendment, you don't see a lot of discussions of personal use of firearms to defend your home against criminals and whatnot. Now, in part, that's due to the technology at the time. Firearms weren't particularly good for defending your home against criminals or someone who might try to invade your home. You could really only get one shot off if it was already loaded, the firearm, and then it would take you about a minute or 2 minutes to reload the firearm and to be able to shoot it again. And the firearms weren't terribly accurate, even at somewhat close range. So not surprised that people didn't think of firearms primarily as a way of defending themselves against criminals. But I think Michael also hits upon an important theme of self-defense writ more broadly. That is, the idea that we would have an armed citizenry to protect us against tyranny was part of a broader conception of self-defense. The idea that we, the people, could defend ourselves if we were faced with criminality of the most tyrannical sort. But I think it's also important when we think about the drafting of the Second Amendment to think about that amendment in the same terms we think about all the other constitutional amendments. My own view is that we shouldn't be bound by the original intent or original understanding of constitutional provisions so strictly that we must understand that the Constitution embodies a set of principles and that those principles evolve and morph to meet the demands of the day. It doesn't matter exactly how the framers thought the Second Amendment would apply to particular laws. It matters how we, the people, over the course of American history, have interpreted that provision. And I think one of the things that Michael's book and my book definitely agree on is that over the course of American history, increasingly the Second Amendment gets interpreted by we, the people, to mean more than just protection for state militias. That it becomes, probably by the 1820s and 1830s, pretty clearly interpreted by many people to be an individual right. It's never a uniform interpretation. The militia theory continues on for a long time and still is with us today. But nonetheless, when we think about the Second Amendment, we should think about it in the same terms we think of other constitutional amendments and not be too bound to what the framers of the Constitution intended to do by that amendment.
Michael Waldman?
I think Adam is right, and I certainly learned a great deal from his scholarship on this, that over time, you really had an evolution where the country grew more individualistic. As soon as the Second Amendment was enacted, the militia system began to crumble. People just stopped showing up. If you look at the drawings of the militias from an earlier period, they all look very heroic, and by the 1820s, they all are sort of lampooned as drunkards and lounging around having a party instead of actually doing military service. The country grew more individualistic. It moved west. People began to think of things in a much more, in a sense, modern, personal, ambition-focused way. So there were plenty of guns, and alongside them, there were plenty of gun laws. And the courts and the Constitution was simply not that much of a factor. It was not very common during the 1800s that the courts would apply any constitutional rights to stop legislatures from acting on almost anything. It happened, but pretty rarely, and almost always applied just to Congress. And so over time, the country evolved, it changed. The original meaning proved not to be a particularly useful guide, and we wound up having gun rights and gun laws going hand in hand without the courts stepping in to articulate a very precise theory of it.
Both of you in your books wrote about some of these laws that were passed at the time. Some towns actually banned guns altogether when you went into them. Others were really just regulating them or asking for registration of them. Adam Winkler, what did you find?
We find really, in some ways, the first modern versions of gun control laws being adopted in the 1820s and over the next 30 years or so, when states start adopting laws to ban the concealed carry of firearms. The framers had gun control laws, too. There were laws that barred, for instance, racial minorities from having guns. There were militia laws, and there were some equivalent to what we might think of as safe storage laws in the founding era, laws that barred people in certain cities from having a loaded firearm in their home. That was largely about protection against fires that could occur because of explosive powder. But nonetheless, we had some gun control laws even in the founding era. But sort of in some ways, you might think that the modern, quote-unquote, regime of gun control begins with concealed carry legislation. One of the surprising things I found in doing the research for my book was that those laws first arose in the South, and they weren't designed particular to ban African Americans from carrying guns in public. African Americans in the South, slaves, were not allowed to own firearms at all, so they couldn't carry them for sure. This was about restricting otherwise law-abiding white people from carrying their guns around because they might actually use those firearms in a duel or an honor killing, which were those kinds of things that were common in that era. And we saw the spread of these concealed carry laws in the early 1800s. And this really forces the courts for the first time to deal with the constitutionality of gun control. They don't address it primarily under the Second Amendment, but there are cases that go up to the state Supreme Court challenging these gun control laws as a violation of state right to bear arms provisions. That's also another thing that's worth remembering when we think about the right to bear arms. We really focus on the Second Amendment most of the time. And in truth, the right to bear arms has been embodied in American law in a variety of other ways, including state constitutional provisions. Today, 43 of 50 states have provisions protecting individuals' right to have guns for personal protection. Those laws became pretty commonplace as states joined the Union in the 1800s. Those provided the first opportunity for courts to address the constitutionality of gun control.
Let's also look at the 14th Amendment, because Michael Waldman's book saw the 14th Amendment authors as incorporating the Second Amendment as an effort for former slaves to protect themselves against organized violence. Michael Waldman, what can you tell us about this?
Of course, the 14th Amendment followed the Civil War and followed the period when hundreds of thousands of African Americans, freedmen, bore arms in the United States Army. And when the war was over, a lot of them returned home. And it became, we tend to think of Grant and Lee at Appomattox, and that was the end of that, but it in fact was a low-grade guerrilla war between the races. Basically, the white Southerners terrorized the African Americans through institutions such as the Ku Klux Klan and other vigilantes. And so the radical Republicans, as they were known, the supporters of civil rights in the United States Congress, they were trying all different kinds of ways to protect the Southern blacks. And one of the key ways was to make sure they could be armed. And that state laws that were passed by the white Southerners right after the Civil War, taking away guns just from African Americans, would be overruled. So one of the purposes for some of the drafters of the 14th Amendment was to make sure that Southern African Americans could get guns. Now, that in some respect begs some of the tough questions that we face today, because first of all, that's not really how they sold it to the American public when they were running for office in 1866, supporting the 14th Amendment, saying the goal of this is to get guns into the hands of the African Americans. It's also not really clear if they meant that everyone had the right to a gun or that you couldn't discriminate between whites and blacks. And it was also the case that the military governments that ran the South in the later part of Reconstruction had plenty of these kinds of laws that Adam Winkler was talking about, dealing with concealed carrying of weapons and other kinds of things like that. So again, even there, there seemed to be a strong feeling that the ability to protect yourself was a basic right, but that somehow that did not run afoul against the idea that you could have strong laws, strong criminal laws, strong public protections. And in any case, when the courts, when Reconstruction ended and the Supreme Court got involved and stripped away so many of the protections that African Americans had, one of the things they stripped away was they ruled that the Bill of Rights just did not apply to the states. And so, and it was states not only that had these Second Amendment type of provisions in their Constitution, but that made criminal laws and gun laws. So the relevance of the Second Amendment got yanked away, and the federal courts were pretty consistent on that for a long time.
And meanwhile, Adam Winkler, you noted in your book that the militias in the South essentially became slave patrols.
Well, that's right. When we think about the well-regulated militia referenced in the Second Amendment, we think of, you know, people getting out their guns ready to fight in an instant, the so-called Minutemen of the Revolutionary period. As Michael points out, soon after the Revolution, people quickly lost faith in the militias as a way of defending the nation. In part, that was the result of the War of 1812, when states like Massachusetts refused to send their militiamen to defend the nation, and as a result, England came in and burned Washington to the ground and probably would have taken over our country again and reversed the revolution had it not been for England having to deal with a little problem in Europe by the name of Napoleon. And that England not been distracted, we probably would have returned to English citizenry. And so the militias in the South were repurposed and became slave patrols. First, before the Civil War, efforts to capture escaped slaves would be undertaken by these state militias so that the slaves would not run away and they would be returned to their owners. Even after the Civil War, where we didn't have the militias having that same use, the militias still survived in some form, at least really up until the 20th century. But as Michael says, it's really nothing like what we know today. Sometimes people say, well, the militia, that's like the National Guard. But that's not the case. The National Guard is a trained group of citizens who fight for the nation, but are heavily trained and are not just sort of the general mass of people. They are a select group of people. Whereas the citizens' militia that the framers envisioned, as Michael says, are virtually the entire male citizenry that were of age and capable of bearing arms. Interestingly enough, there is a country, a nation that still has these state militias. Switzerland still defends itself without a standing army and has citizen militias. And in Switzerland, they provide their young men with so-called military assault rifles at the age of 18, and a box of ammunition. So there are some of these militias still out there, just not in the United States.
You're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. And we're talking about the construction of the Second Amendment over the history of the U.S. into what it is today. We're speaking with Michael Waldman, whose book is called The Second Amendment, A Biography, and Adam Winkler, whose book is called A Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Thematically, if we were to continue down this path, we then find that the Black Panthers continued this idea of being able to have guns to protect oneself. Adam Winkler, this is something you elaborated on quite a bit in your book.
It's interesting in doing my research for Gunfight how many ties between the NRA and the modern gun rights movement and the Black Panthers there were. In many ways, the Black Panthers sort of gave rise to the modern gun rights movement, at least provided various models and themes that the NRA and the modern gun rights movement would pick up upon. And part of that was that the Black Panthers were formed in the 1960s by some African-American activists in Oakland who were disappointed with the progress of the civil rights movement. They thought that peaceful, nonviolent protest of the sort that Martin Luther King engaged in wasn't getting us very far, had not brought the promised rewards, and that instead the African Americans still confronted a hostile police force in cities like Oakland, and people needed the right to bear arms to protect themselves. We remember Malcolm X's famous photograph of him peering out the window with an M1 carbine in his hand, and that kind of embodied the philosophy of the Black Panthers too. And the Black Panthers very explicitly said, we have a Second Amendment right to have our guns. And they said, we have a Second Amendment right not only to have guns in our home to protect ourselves against criminals, we have a right to have those guns in public where we face great threats. And not only that, we have a right to have those guns to use them against the tyranny of a government that's hostile to our rights. An idea that, of course, became very popular among the gun rights activists in the 80s and 90s. And it's one of the ironies that gun control laws that were adopted to try to disarm the Black Panthers, like California's law that was passed in 1968 to disarm them, that those laws helped spark a backlash that led to gun rights support among rural white conservatives. Even though those laws were originally designed to outlaw guns or to eliminate gun ownership or reduce it by urban black left-leaning radicals.
Let's look specifically at the NRA. Michael Waldman, you opened Chapter 5 with the NRA billing itself as the, quote, nation's longest standing civil rights organization. You say that's not how it started.
Well, it started after the Civil War, where the Union officers had grown perturbed by the poor marksmanship of their troops. And just as Adam Winkler said, before that, the guns were not very accurate. It sort of didn't matter if you were a good shot or not, because it wouldn't necessarily work anyway. But by the end of the war, it was a much more mechanized military. And these former officers felt that they needed to keep training people and preserve the marksmanship. They recruited General Ambrose Burnside, who we know for his famous whiskers, sideburns come from his name, and as the honorary chair. And they were not a lobbying organization. They gave guns. They trained people. Over time, they were especially identified with preparedness, but especially eventually with the interests of sportsmen, of hunters, and people who were concerned about that. And while it's true that the NRA lobbied occasionally, it was not deeply involved in politics. And, for example, when the cities began passing gun laws, when people crowded into the cities in the beginning of the 20th century, and states and cities began passing laws dealing with carrying guns in that context, the NRA didn't get involved. And then when the federal government first passed a federal gun law in the 1930s, actually to deal with bank robbers, Bonnie and Clyde, and people like that, who were now crossing state lines with their newfangled technology of the getaway car, they passed under Franklin Roosevelt the first federal gun law, and the NRA not only didn't oppose it, it was asked in testimony before Congress, are you worried that this affects the Constitution? And they said, we haven't given it any thought from that perspective. Well, along comes the 1960s, along comes the turmoil of the 60s and the perceived liberalism of the courts and the social unrest. And in the 1970s, you saw a really sharp change in the NRA. Not only in the NRA, but the NRA, it was very visible. In 1977, the NRA indicated that it was going to move its headquarters from Washington, D.C. to Colorado as a symbol of its retreat from politics. And at the annual convention in 77 in Cincinnati, it was called the Revolt at Cincinnati, 1,000 activists came and essentially deposed the leadership of the NRA, and a far more radical, really, group of leaders came in and really changed the focus both to strong opposition to gun control, but also a constitutional crusade, really elevating the Second Amendment and its language about the right to keep and bear arms to the heart of the NRA's mission. And to this day, when you go to the NRA headquarters in Virginia and you go into the lobby, there on the wall in big letters is the Second Amendment, except it's the part about the well-regulated militia is simply edited out. They have two dots. They don't even get three dots. And that really began, that shift came in that revolt in Cincinnati, and it was interestingly at a moment when we saw a lot of traditional American institutions move very far to the right in response to the 60s. You had the churches, the evangelical churches and the Baptists, same thing. A lot of the farm organizations, you had the tax revolt in California in 1979. You had the Sagebrush Rebellion against Interior Department environmental policies. It all became very insurrectionist in tone, and that wound up fusing with the Republican Party in many ways as a kind of a very potent political coalition, and that helped create the environment we're in now on this issue.
Adam Winkler, you also detailed quite a bit about the NRA in your book. You noted that they were at the forefront of gun control laws in the 20s and 30s.
Well, that's right. In the 1920s and 30s, the president of the NRA was instrumental in drafting laws that restricted people's ability to carry guns in public. These laws required you to have a permit before you could carry a gun in public, and only awarded permits to people who had good moral character or a good reason to carry a gun in public. The idea was to limit people's ability to have guns in public. It's interesting that today the NRA is filing lawsuits all over the country challenging those very same laws that they helped pass. And indeed, there's not many of them left. Over the last 30 or 40 years, there's been a big push among gun rights advocates to loosen the concealed carry rules. And about 40 states have loosened their rules and changed those laws so that it is a lot easier today to carry guns in public than it was under the NRA's version, preferred legislation of the 1920s. And indeed, one of the interesting things is if you look at the American Rifleman, which is the NRA signature publication that it sends out to all members, you can go through back issues in the 1930s and 40s and 50s, and it's amazing. You can just sit there and look in the library, as I've done, and you just go page after page after page looking for some mention of the Second Amendment, and you just don't find it. It's just not there. And today, if you looked at the American Rifleman, you're pretty much guaranteed to see the Second Amendment referred to on almost every page. Now, that's not to say that the NRA has completely created this vision of the Second Amendment out of whole cloth. There were court cases in the 1800s that referred to the Second Amendment as protecting a right of people to have guns and to carry guns in public. Just the other day, someone sent me an article written by H.L. Mencken in 1920, where he talks about gun control and makes specific mention of the Second Amendment. So it was out there, and some people did think about it, but that was not the NRA's view of the Second Amendment. And that view of the Second Amendment was really a product of modern-day political organizing. In fact, I recommend readers to check out Michael Waldman-authored piece on Politico. That's just a great piece about how the Second Amendment was changed as a matter of political debate and political mobilization, and really provides a model for people on both sides of the political spectrum about how to shape interpretation of the Constitution through mobilization of the people. Because ultimately in America, that's really what counts. It doesn't really matter what the framers of the Constitution thought, intended, or wanted to do, despite all of the discussion of originalism. It really matters but what we, the people, as a matter of political mobilization, are willing to fight for and to endorse. You're seeing that now in the same-sex marriage controversy. It's completely irrelevant to whether same-sex marriage will be constitutionally protected. What's completely relevant is what the framers of the 14th Amendment after the Civil War thought about same-sex marriage. It's not coming up in any of the judicial opinions. It's not a prominent part of the public debate. Why is that? Because I don't think on issues of principle like this, at the end of the day, it really doesn't really matter what the framers of the Constitution originally thought. It matters what we, the people, think about it today.
Both of you have also talked about the big change with the Heller case that came up in the Supreme Court. The court really put its stamp on the new meaning of the Second Amendment. Michael Waldman, what happened in the case, and how has this reshaped our discourse?
Well, the Heller case was only heard, and the decision only came down, in 2008. That was the first time that the Supreme Court articulated the holding that the Second Amendment recognizes or confers an individual right to a gun for self-defense. And it was a very significant opinion. It was written by Antonin Scalia. He, of course, is the very vocal proponent of the idea of originalism, or as he might call it, textualism, that the only legitimate way to interpret a constitutional provision is not, as Adam Winkler just said, in the context of the evolution of the country, but by finding a way to go back in time to understand what the framers had in mind or the original public meaning of the words. And Scalia is prone to consulting old dictionaries to find out what the words meant to people at the time. I think he looks sometimes like a Scrabble player trying to prove that that triple score word really exists. It doesn't strike me as the most effective way of really understanding the role of the Constitution, at least what it ought to be. The Heller case was brought not by the NRA, and Adam Winkler really does a fantastic job of telling the story of the case in his book, Gunfight. It was actually brought by a small group of libertarian lawyers who thought the NRA was too timid. Now, the NRA had spent decades helping to foment scholarship, change public opinion, move the elected officials and move the branches. It didn't want to go to the Supreme Court until it was ready, and these activists pushed it. And the case eventually went up. It was a security guard at a federal court office building who wanted to have his gun at home in Washington, D.C. And it was a 5-4 ruling. All the questions just about in the argument were about colonial practices and original intent. There were almost no questions about the things that would previously have been the basis for a Supreme Court ruling. What is the status of gun laws now? What is the problem of gun violence? How do you enforce something like this? It was, in some sense, the triumph of Justice Scalia's vision of originalism. Now, a lot of progressives sort of shrugged and said, well, what do you expect? Some version of that. A lot of conservative judges and writers scalded the opinion. They said, this is just exactly the same kind of loosey-goosey constitutionalism that we've been fighting against. That one conservative judge said, this is as bad as Roe versus Wade, which is, you know, the deepest insult that you can throw, if that's your point of view. What's interesting is that Heller also said, look, like all individual rights, this is an individual right. It applied it only to having a gun that is in common use for protection of your home. That was the explicit holding of the case. And it said, like all individual rights, there are limits. And Scalia indicated some limits, but basically made clear that it was an individual right, but with limits. So, of course, deciding what those limits are and deciding what the reach of the Second Amendment is outside the home, that's consumed courts and legislatures, and that's what the fight is nowadays and going forward.
Adam Winkler.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about the Heller case was how it did encourage courts to uphold gun control laws. That for all of the originalism that sort of disguises the opinion, it's dressed up in originalist garb. Towards the end of the opinion, Justice Scalia puts in a paragraph where he says, well, nothing in this opinion should call into question laws banning felons from possessing firearms or laws preventing the mentally ill from possessing firearms or laws regulating guns in sensitive places like schools and government buildings and refers to commercial sale restrictions. Something that might be equivalent to background checks or something like that. And the truth is that none of those exceptions that the court recognized were grounded in originalist methodology. They weren't laws that the framers of the Constitution had. They had some gun control laws, as we've talked about already in today's show, but they didn't have the gun control laws that Justice Scalia said were exceptions. And indeed, since the Heller case, we've seen court after court after court uphold challenged gun control laws. In several hundred of these cases now, Heller was an invitation for everyone to challenge any gun control law they're ever charged with. And the truth is very few gun laws have been struck down. I don't know what that means for the future. More gun laws may be struck down in the future. I think the biggest open question right now is whether cities like Los Angeles and New York, the cities that Michael and I live in, or whether those cities can have concealed carry policies that give discretion to law enforcement officers over who can get those permits, or whether those cities have to provide permits to any law-abiding person who does mandatory training or meets some minimal requirements. That's really the big open question, and one of the interesting things is that the court seemed really gung-ho on the Second Amendment for a couple of years. 2008, we had the Heller case. 2010, we had a case called McDonald against City of Chicago that applied the Second Amendment and said the Second Amendment applied equally to state and local governments, not just the federal government, as at issue in the Heller case. But the court has subsequently had several cases petitioned to the justices asking them to rule on concealed carry permitting policies. And the justices have just seemingly not shown any interest in it. Not clear at all why the justices keep avoiding the issue now after they seem so gung-ho on it. So there's still a lot of uncertainty in the law, but one thing is clear. Heller did not lead to a huge scale back of American gun control laws.
And it's really true that one of the dissents in the case by Justice Breyer, which said basically, well, let's stipulate, sure, it's an individual right, what then? That's, as he says, the beginning, not the end of the analysis. In some ways, that dissent has been a guide for how courts have ruled more than anything else. And in fact, some of the gun rights activists and attorneys who work on it, they've likened the whole thing in the courts to massive resistance, the resistance of southern states to the desegregation decisions in the 1950s. You know, it's actually a rather striking, so far, judicial consensus on most of these things.
Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law and author of The Second Amendment, a biography, and Adam Winkler, professor of law at UCLA and the author of Gunfight, the Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to all who made this program possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Armudian. See you next week.